Pastors Larry and Tiz Huck welcome you to another Larry Huck Ministries podcast. We pray this teaching will fill you with God's wisdom, anointing, and revelation knowledge. Thank you for your prayers and faithful support.
Well, good evening to you, and so glad you decided to welcome those by stream as well tonight. And I want to do something just a little different tonight. This is kind of the, this is the end or the final session of the month for our series on marriage and money. And kind of the end of the night or the end of the series, I've got a good friend of mine here that I'm going to introduce here in just a minute. But before I started or before we got into our discussion for tonight, Shane, I want to kind of recap a couple things because this is our fourth session that we've had now on Wednesday night concerning marriage and money. And I kind of want to just recap a couple of things to you, just to kind of sum it all up in maybe just a couple of things, whether if it's the marriage part of the discussion or money. I think it really all boils down to commitment. Commitment. You're either committed or you're not committed. It's either commitment through the storm and the rain, through the heartache and the pain. You got to be committed. You're either going to be committed partially where you don't get success, or you're going to be fully committed where you get 100% of what you're looking for. I think that commitment is not just a feeling, it's an action. You can't just feel commitment, you got to actually act on commitment. Many people have actually, and I'm talking marriage part of it and the money part of it here. You know, I said the last time I spoke that, you know, we don't always, and I just said commitment and feeling, it's not just a feeling, but I said the last time I spoke was the, we don't always come home as I'm married, and some of you are, most of you are here too, is you don't always come home or on your way home feeling in love. Sometimes it just, you don't have that unction, it's just not the same feeling every time. And that, but that's not what commitment is. It's not about a feeling. It's about a mindset. So you either changed your mindset or you're going to go through the same old thing. In other words, it could be a different year, a different time in your life. But if you keep doing the same old thing, the same old way of doing things, guess what? You're going to get the same old outcome that you've been getting for 5, 10, 15, or your entire life. So it's all about your commitment to what you're standing. Some people have never fully went through and committed themselves and followed through all the way to the end and actually realized their dream or the reality of a goal, setting a goal. We talked about goals the last time as well. Many have not even followed through with their dreams in the course of their life. But if you follow through with your dreams and your reality and make it a part of your life, the part of what you set your mind to, then it can become a reality to you. And so I just kind of wanted to throw that in for tonight as we end on commitment to, I'll say, finance tonight. We hit both of them the last, Pastor Nancy hit more on marriage the last time. But I've got a good friend of mine here tonight. His name is I'm going to let you introduce yourself, Shane. Okay. Give us your name and a little bit of history about yourself. And instead of me reading it off, I'm going to let you do it.
All right. My name's Shane Dierman. I am, I guess my age doesn't really matter.
Doesn't matter, but, no.
Yeah.
We're okay.
I'm married to a beautiful lady, have three beautiful children. I've spent the last 20-plus years in private corporate America. And have honed my skills in everything related to money. A little about my background. I actually am the son of an Assemblies of God minister, fourth generation pastor. I was the only one in the family that did not go into full-time ministry, and the primary reason was because we were poor. We were dirt poor. And my association with serving the Lord was we're going to be poor. And I refused to go down that road. I hated, you know, wearing hand-me-down clothes and having just a stigma over my head of being a second-rate, not citizen, but just second-rate. You just, it's something you carry. And Pastor John, one thing that you said that actually was on my mind today as I was just kind of meditating and praying and just putting notes together on this was, it's all about your mindset. You change your thinking, you change your life. And that's really where it started for me. It wasn't a lottery type of thing. It was just really doing deep dives into God's word and discovering for myself God's principles for attaining wealth and changing your reality. And it's a compound effect, and it happens over the course of your life. It's not going to happen. There may be seasons where you can really gain some significant ground, and then you can come through some rough storms where you take four steps back. But the key is, just like you said, you got to keep committed and keep moving forward.
You know, that's exactly right. I'm glad we're kind of on the same page there, Shane. One thing Shane didn't mention, he's an MBA in business administration. He's there from TCU University. He's also got a certificate of financial management from Cornell University as well. So I brought Shane in as more or less an expert just to discuss some things, Shane, that I get questions all the time. And tonight we're ending on more of a financial ending rather than a marriage ending, because we've had several more focused on marriage in the last few weeks. So I wanted to kind of focus our center of attention tonight just more the money direction. And I want to ask you a few questions, just you and I, we'll kind of back and forth here with it, some, you know, questions maybe that I get most of the time, and just for discussion here tonight, and maybe at the end we might even open it up, or there may be somebody watching by stream who may want to send us some questions later on, and we can possibly get back to them. But
well, while you're, I just wanted to put a nugget in there. So this, and I love what you guys do, because marriage and finance they're interwoven, and it's a critical piece of home life. And if your house isn't in order with regards to your finances, then nothing's going to be in order. It's one of the number one reasons for divorce in America today is financial troubles. So if that's grounded and you've got a solid understanding and you're working together, then it's going to make for a better home.
It sets you up for success.
Yes, sir.
Sets you up for some positive results. Yeah. Shane, the first question that I'm going to pose to you that we'll have a discussion on, maybe that has come up several times to me, is what is a credit score and how or why is it important to us?
Okay. So the credit score, by definition, is the FICO score. You've got three credit unions that are monitoring everybody and everything related to purchases, and it's a weighted average. It's made up of your past debt, the time of debt, the type of debt, new debt. But when you're looking to make a purchase, how many in here have ever bought a new car? Anyone? So the rate that they quote you is directly a result of your score. And the lower the score, the better the interest rate. Or I'm sorry, the higher the score, the better the interest rate. So the ability to go into a dealership if they've got promos and get a 0% interest, so you're not paying a dollar over what the sticker price is on the car, with the exception of TTNL tax and title and licensing, all that, is huge, because that results in thousands of dollars. Those dollars that slip through your fingers can be turned and utilized for retirement, putting it into some sort of bucket that's going to be setting you up over the long term for success.
Yeah. So, Shane, people have always thought that what you just said there is that credit score had to do just buying a house. That's what majority of people have always said. Well, we got to have a good credit score to eventually buy a house. But as one of the, you kind of hinted on that there, it's not always just about buying one thing. It has a lot to do with, well, it's the measure some guy or some industry determines whether or not they trust you to pay back what they loan you. So they're going to weigh that average based on past payment history, past whether you're late on things. So just because you've been you've paid everything, actually being late affects points off your credit score. Now it's not just about a high credit score to buy a house or buy a car. And what Shane was saying is absolutely correct. That the higher the score, the better rate or better confidence, I'll just say in layman terms, confidence they have in your ability to pay back what you've borrowed. But it also has to do with even your insurance. So the higher your credit score, the better the insurance premium you will have. So if you have a low credit score, the chances of you having a lower premium, in other words, you have your neighbor gets this rate, he tells you, go see my agent because I pay this for my car. And then you go to the same agent and you don't get the same rate. Well, there's a reason for that.
That's right.
Because there's ability, that they weigh that on ability. The second thing is even if you're not buying a house or buying a car, if you're just simply renting or trying to rent an apartment somewhere, that has a direct effect on whether they let you lease something or not. If you have a low score, there is a possibility that they will not lease to you, especially if there's two people side by side and one has a 700 plus score and one has a 400 plus score. I can assure you they're going to shift that piece of paper in leasing to the higher score. Am I right?
Well, and they don't have to be apologetic about it at all. So it's not you being a high risk because of bad credit is not a protected class. It's banking institutions that are mitigating their risk and exposure. And if they feel confident, you got a good track record, your number's high, you pay things off on time. It's a good thing, and it now, because of the digitalization age that we're in, and all information is readily available to everyone. So even, you know, what I teach my children, my oldest is at the university now, and my second one's about to be starting college this fall, is every decision you make matters. So, you know, we'll get them a credit card so that they can start the process of building credit, because the Dave Ramsey approach, and hopefully this is not going to, you know, come back to bite me on TV or whatever, but it's not a bad plan to get you out of debt if that's been a problem in the past. But the statements that I've heard and have read is that the FICO score is only encouraging you to get into debt, and that's absolutely wrong. Because you will have zero ability to do anything without a good credit score. And even potential employers they're looking at the whole package. So if you're someone that's got a terrible credit history, they look at you as possibly a risk to bringing you on to the organization. So college kids coming out of college, they're looking at social media, they're looking at your credit score. Do you have a clean pass? Do you actually have a breadcrumb trail that's showing responsibility, or have you been just a problem kid?
So the next part of that, and I'm going to comment here on with that, is that, okay, so let's say that you do. So the next question is, so what do I do? Right? Like, it's not the end of the world. It's not going to hopefully last forever if you do what you're supposed to. So the number one thing that I can tell you to do is, how do you fix your credit score? Doesn't take rocket science to figure this one out. Guess what? You pay your bills on time and you don't miss any. Now, it's regularly updated monthly. Most of the Experian, TransUnion, Equifax are always updating on a monthly basis. So you say, well, it's going to take me so long. Well, it starts like we said the other day, is, or the last time I saw it, is it's a process. The steps of a righteous man, or that's Bible. So the steps of repairing your credit is up to you. It's a step. So how do you start? You start this month. So if your credit card, if your credit score or your FICO score is not where you want it to be, it's not where you feel it should be, then your first step is to take action.
That's right. It's not a life sentence, but it's going to take an intentional, put a plan together and stick to the plan and work towards getting your credit score up. And it'll happen relatively quickly.
It can happen relatively. It's a month-to-month basis.
Yeah.
So you take steps every month.
Yeah.
Next question here is, I'm going to tie a little bit to that, Shane,
okay.
Is that is there a such thing, and there's a lot of concepts, a lot of theories out there, is there a such thing as good debt?
Well, Dave Ramsey would say no, but
I would disagree with that strongly.
Right. So,
well, I'm not asking Dave Ramsey tonight.
Exactly.
I'm asking Shane.
So, for a lot of, but that is especially in the church circle, it's been accepted as gospel, and nobody's really challenged it. But the reality is, a mortgage on a house for a lot of families is the largest asset they'll ever own throughout their life. That is an example of good debt. Now, it's directly tied to your credit score. So if you've got a good credit score, you have the ability to get FHA loans, which mitigate how much money you have to put down.
A better rate, that's what you're saying.
A better interest rate, as well as the amount of money that they require you to put down. So it's huge.
Let me comment on that, too, with the whole bad debt or good debt, bad debt thing. You know, like you mentioned Dave Ramsey. I'm a big fan of Dave.
And I am too. I've got a couple of his books.
Mr. Hogan out there, and several others as well. And I do my best not to be in debt. But let me kind of tie this together a little bit for you here. An appreciating asset that you're going into, like you said, your home, to me, that's the number one. Then I consider that a good debt. If you're purchasing or going into debt, borrowing money with no underlying, and write this down, or you put this in your head, with no underlying asset that will appreciate, is bad.
That's
okay,
right.
So an example, and I'll let you give an example here in a minute too, is I'm going to go into debt for my Disney vacation that I'm going to take 5 years to pay off. Disney vacation or shoes, clothes, it doesn't matter. And it takes me that many years to pay off or even 1 year or 2 months. Neither one of those purchases, that underlying asset, has any value moving forward. It's not an appreciating asset. Your home is probably the only thing, unless you can correct me on this, Shane, it's probably the only thing that I can think of that could be, and it has for the last, I don't know, 100 years, mm-hmm. an appreciating asset. Comment.
No, that's absolutely correct. I mean, anything real estate, whether it's your personal property, commercial property, taking it a step further, you know, investing in properties like that are income earning. So if they're, there's a hard underlying asset tied to it. And that's,
I guess I'm more lenient in that direction because it has been good to me in terms of investing in an appreciating asset versus a rental property or your own home. I've bought and sold several homes, and I've never had in my years of experience, never had one that did not appreciate. So,
correct. Well, and everybody remembers the 08-09 financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
The market cut in half. People's pensions, retirements were cut in half. The value on your home, now it was affected more in some inflated economies. So you had microeconomies within the U.S. So if you saw what happened in Arizona or Nevada,
Las Vegas,
Michigan, mm-hmm. Florida was hit pretty hard as well.
Mm-hmm.
Texas, especially in the North Texas area, we saw based on the data, it was like a 3 to 10%
yeah.
drop in valuation, which that you still have an underlying asset that has significant value.
Well, so, it circled back around, Shane, because yes, there is, even in the markets, they go up and down, but the key was staying in, and all those who held on to their appreciating asset,
yes,
it may have went through a dip in 08 and 09, but by 19 and 20 here, they doubled,
yes,
from where they were then.
Exactly right, because I think it peaked in 09, it was Q1 09 when it dropped from 16,000 mm-hmm. something to around 7,900. Those that just left it alone, given the leverage on the debt, those stocks tied to mm-hmm. corporations or mm-hmm. whatever it was, were able to weather the storm. Like, I had investments in some companies that filed Chapter 11 or whichever one, that it basically the stock value goes to zero. So in that case, it didn't work out that way. If I had had that same money
real estate
in a property, I would still have an asset at the end of the day that was worth $50,000. Mm-hmm. So it's a...
Absolutely. I want to go on to the next question here, because I want to get through as many as we can before we run out of time here. I've heard people say that, do I need a will or a living trust? Why don't you address, number one, what is it and why would we need it?
Okay, so we'll start with the living will. Is it literally can be a handwritten piece of paper that is stating exactly what you want to happen while you're still living. And it's addressing if you become incapacitated. So I worked with a gentleman that had a stroke to the point of losing his ability to speak. So now you no longer have the ability to communicate, and he was paralyzed with his writing hand. So it gives you the ability to spell out in detail, this is how I want to be taken care of, this is how I want my estate taken care of, this is all of your estate, including family, day-to-day operations, all of that can be defined in a living will.
Okay, and let's talk about what happens if one passes away. Eventually everyone will pass away at some point in time. What happens to someone, let's say, who has an estate, who has assets, things like that, and they pass away and they don't?
So that living will is touching on why you're still living, but it also addresses, in the event of death, this is who I want my children to live with. This is, you identify and address all of that. Failure to do that, even if it's handwritten and dated and it's just put somewhere in a drawer in your house, failure to do that, the state ultimately gets the value of all of those assets. So if you owned a house and a car and two guns and...
Even if you had a couple of kids.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you had kids and you, in your mind, you would like to have done that, or you had planned to do something like mm-hmm. that, planned to set up an estate will or trust.
Yes.
And just, even though you meant well, and even though they're your flesh and blood, does that change anything?
Well, you can, if you've got, let's say your spouse, you will, it goes to probate, so it goes to court, and then typically the assets immediately transfer to the surviving spouse. And then it would go to the kids. Now, there will be tax exposure with the children taking that on that the spouse would not have incurred.
Do you think it's, and I've heard you mention with the just a handwritten something, you could. Would you encourage, though, to take an extra step? Because you can do these things on LegalZoom.com for next to nothing. Have it notarized, and then, what I have done myself, I'm just saying that, because I didn't want just anything. I wanted everything listed and take some time, because there are forms out there that, and I encourage you to do it, to LegalZoom.com. I'm not doing any promotion for them, but I'm just saying you can do it anywhere online. Print out some of those forms and start listing, because you'd be surprised what you have and what you would like to see for your kids, your grandkids, your wife, and go ahead and spell it out. Go ahead and, I've had mine notarized, and then I went ahead and put a copy in the safe, and I let my wife know. I have this what I call important file at home that my wife knows where things are. Then I have a safe, and then I gave it to my father-in-law, and then I've given one to my brother just so he has
some redundancy.
Show some redundancy to where no one forgets where it might be or whatever. Right. But I took the action of listing everything from checking accounts to savings accounts to properties to special account numbers, yep. Bank account numbers. And, you know, you mentioned probate because you don't want to don't make it hard on the family. You can write everything on a piece of paper, but it makes it a lot easier by just taking these forms and go ahead and spell it out on what you'd like to do. Go ahead and make sure they have the where the things are. Because, and I say this because I have run into so many people who went for a year or 2 years trying to figure it out because nothing was left in detail.
Yep.
So am I right on that?
Yes, absolutely. And one other thing that I would add, going back to the, you may be single, you may be someone that has no family, so you're going, well, why, you know, what does it matter? If it goes to the state, it goes to the state. You actually have the ability to still, through the power of a will, designate that it can be quest to a nonprofit, like ministry, like Larry Huck Ministries. You look at the kind of impact that it's made on my life, and I'm sure many of yours, you actually have the ability to designate that even to help further the legacy of the ministry and them continuing to change lives, or could even designate how that's allocated for use. So that's another thought as well. But going to the trust part of it, that's taking it a step further where you're sitting down with an attorney and you're taking basically the content of what's in the will, but now you're going to go ahead and move and set up your assets inside a living trust so that it's just better defined. Everything is clear who gets what. It bypasses the probate process, so now it's not held up in court while they're determining the legitimacy of the will or anything else. It just kind of streamlines the process.
And don't think too hard of this. Don't think because it says living, the part of that you need to understand is you can make changes.
Yes.
Because you're living, it doesn't mean because you write something down it can't be changed or it's notarized. You can still change it. That's the whole point of living trust. So
correct.
You could, as you're living, we all know things change. Unfortunately, people don't have the same wife all the time. And there's divorces happen. There's kids. There are things that happen. So you can make changes. Son-in-laws that are no longer part of the... Anyway, so you can make changes. Next question here. Shane is... I get this question a lot. Is there an ideal age to retire?
Well, retirement is more about the financial means than it is a specific number. We've all kind of had in our head that, you know, 65, that's where you're out of the game. But the reality is, if you've been smart with putting it away, like we've been discussing, and making the right investments in the type of assets that are going to continue to appreciate and grow in value, then you can retire earlier than that typical 65, 60 years old. You know, I don't know that it's biblical to retire specifically, but it's more about the financial means than it is a specific age where you got to tap and say, I'm out.
Absolutely. You know, and I think Pastor said this before, too. The Bible doesn't speak of retirement. Mm-hmm. I use that word, kind of loosely.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the Bible or God made us to produce. As long as we're producing, we're flowing, we're functioning. So God did not make us to stop producing. Just because you don't work as hard, and so I'll use that instead of retirement, I'll use not working as hard.
Right.
We're still producing, using that time to further the gospels, further the camp, spend more time in volunteering at the church, doing a side hobby that you love. But it just gives you the mean to where you're not doing that 9-to-5 grind, I guess, on a regular basis. Which
exactly.
Brings me to the next thing, Shane, is that
When
should we start planning for retirement? Is it a 20, 30, or 50, or when?
Yesterday. Absolutely. And I, you know, so, you know, my background and even the upbringing this wasn't something that was taught in my home. My dad would go out and work in the barn when he wasn't, you know, focused on ministry. But that mindset only, it just perpetuates. And the frustration with that, I put myself through school mid-20s, got my undergrad, but it just was kind of a lifelong journey and a determination to change that reality. And I really see even the poverty mindset, it becomes generational because of that lack of teaching and training and investing in yourself so that you can invest in others.
Give us some examples, Shane, of where would you start planning for retirement? Say it doesn't matter what, it could be 30, it could be 20, it could be someone sitting here that's 50 years old or 55 years old. Give us some avenues to start with.
So if you're if you work for a corporation, 401ks typically are what everybody's aware of, which is pre-tax monies going into a 401k. My recommendation would be that you are contributing to your 401k up to whatever your employer is matching and not a dollar more, because there's other retirement vehicles that you could be diversifying, so you're putting it in several buckets that all are accumulating. So if one doesn't perform as well as the other, you've got an average that's really solid. For those that maybe, like when I started out, while I was in high school, I was working construction, and that continued up until the age of 24. The guys I worked for half the time were paying cash. There weren't really 401ks that were even discussed, much less any other kind of benefits. So in that case, an IRA or an individual retirement account gives you the same kind of ability. There's two. You've got a traditional and then a Roth. So a traditional is going to be pre-tax or what's called qualified money, and then a Roth would be after you paid taxes on it. Both are good. If you're not doing anything, that's a great place to start. They do have limitations. You can only contribute a maximum of $500 a month or $6,000 a year, I think, based on 2020 limits that come out every year. If you're over the age of 50, it's $7,000 a year, so it's a little more, but it still limits you.
Over the age of 50, I think, or 55, there's a catch-up. 50, I think
it's
there's a catch-up.
It's a catch-up clause is what it's called at the age of 50.
50, yeah.
So on a 401k, you as an individual under the age of 50 can contribute up to $19,500. And your employer can match whatever they choose to match. If they were to match 100%, I would say do it, because now you're getting an immediate 100% return on your investment day one. Mm-hmm. And then it would have a compound interest in what it was accumulating. And that's called the 415 limits. And I would encourage you to get on IRS.gov and the ERISA guidelines and just read it for yourself. It's really fun reading. It's a great way to put you to sleep.
Put you to sleep is right, yeah. I sort of say anything, if you were going that other direction, I was going to have to correct you on that one. I've been on the side of it. It will put you absolutely to sleep. But and I want to encourage you also at the end, I want to kind of open up for questions, so kind of be thinking up some questions that you might have for Shane or myself. But I want to comment here something, Shane, with that, with the retirement. I think the key aspect here, guys, is to make, it's like we've been talking about, is to make a decision to start sometime and start somewhere. So at this point in time, whether in Shane, you know, with your master's and stuff like that, we're talking 401ks and Roths and traditionals and SEPs and things like that. And maybe that's over, you know, that's a little too much information to some right now. But I think the important part is to start thinking and to determine to start with something and somewhere, because you can research, or you can even talk to Shane, and we'll have given the opportunity at the end to even sign up if they want to ask questions or get with you later on.
Sure.
But I think the important thing is to start with something in planning. You say, well, I can't because I don't. Well, you got to figure it out at some point. That has to be one of those If you remember, I talked a couple weeks ago, it has to be one of those priority things of goals of that you've got to learn to establish as a priority for your life. If you don't start sometime, you never will. And I say that because statistics tell us, and I'm not saying, you know, it will always happen a certain way, but statistics do tell us, and in my research, and I think, Shane, in yours, that if you were 25, 30 years old 30 years ago, and you're, say, you're 60 years old now or 59 and a half, and you would have been, and you would have invested $500. Now, this is the about what an average car payment is, $500 a month. Am I right? Somewhere in that neighborhood. If you would have started then with $500 a month and the average growth stock mutual fund, that by the time you were 60-year-old, 60, 62, you would have been a multimillionaire.
That's correct.
With just $500 a month. Now, let's say it was just $250 or $200 or $100. Well, it would probably have been in the, based on the statistics, you would have had several hundred thousand, maybe you weren't a multimillionaire, but with even that amount of money, starting at the age of 25 or 30, 30 years ago, you would have been already at that. So it doesn't have to be thousands of dollars is what I'm trying to say right off the bat. It could be...
Right. Yeah, and that looks like a mountain if it's a big number. But starting somewhere, it absolutely will grow into something of significance. And it goes beyond what just, you know, putting it in a coffee can and burying it in the backyard does. It needs to be put into some sort of investment where it's getting the benefits of compounded interest and that sort of thing.
Yeah. You mentioned that just right off the top there with compound interest, and that's really how this thing works when you're investing. So why don't you explain to us what is compound interest and how does it affect what we do in investment?
So compound interest is, it's basically interest on interest, and it's if you had $100 and it earned 10% interest at the end of that year, you would have $110. The following year, if it earned 10%, you would have $122. Mm-hmm. And it continues to grow like that. So you're getting the benefit of the initial $100 investment plus the value or the delta of that 10% growth. And in the second year, you're getting 10% on both that original investment plus the value of that earned interest that first year.
Yeah.
And it just continues. And it's amazing to see tables that show how that grows over time. It really is significant. Plus, you're going to be continuing to contribute that $100. So it's not just the $110 at the end of the year. Now you're working with $210 plus the interest on that second year.
Anybody got any questions? I know we're throwing out a lot of things here. You got any questions real quick that might be of interest to you that maybe you've been thinking about over the last couple of, even the last few weeks with marriage and money? Any questions? Yeah.
Would student loans be considered a good debt?
Okay, so that's a yes and a no, depends on who you're asking, okay? So that can have a value. And I'll go back to, now I'm going to let you answer that one as well, Shane. I'm going to give her my input, then you give her your input.
Sure.
It can be a yes and a no because of two reasons. Is when you're borrowing money to better yourself, yes, it can be. However, if the amount that you're borrowing, and I say that because I hear horror stories of, I got $160,000 in student loan debt with a sociology degree or a psychology degree or a, where the average pay is about $30,000 and you've got the equivalent of a house debt for, does that make sense? Now, if you're taking a student loan and you're going to be a nurse practitioner, you're going to be going to a community college where the debt ratio is much lower than a high institution, so somewhere like a private school, SMU, is versus a community college, then yes, because it can benefit you versus where you are now. But the biggest problem, because the number one debt, really, that as far as I'm, it's one or two, Shane, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. Yeah. In America, it's something, how many trillion dollars? I can't remember exactly. I was studying on this the other day. Good question. It's student loan debt. That is the number one debt that people have taken out that they're still paying on because they went longer than expected.
Yep.
They changed their major twice or three times, and they didn't work through college. They went to the highest institution, and by the time they graduated, they had a degree that they're making $40,000 or $30,000 a year, and it simply wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
So.
No, you're absolutely right, and it does depend, but the area of study depends, making sure you're very frugal with what the use of those funds are. And a funny story, if I can take like 10 seconds.
Yeah, please.
I met a lady that absolutely blew me away. So she was now working on her master's. All 6 years were on student loans. She didn't work, which she could have, but she wasn't even using the money just for school. And she had already accumulated. So her parents had co-signed on some of her loans. Long story short, the parents lost their home as a result of the bad debt that she had incurred. It put the whole family into a tailspin. And it was a psychology degree, and then the master's was something else like fingernail clipping or something.
Yeah, yeah,
I don't
yeah.
know. It was crazy. So, and that is the only debt that stays with you for life. So even
yes.
if you go through a bankruptcy,
yes.
there's not debt forgiveness on that. They're going to make sure they get their
the
money
The only
first.
Way that student loans go away, this is the only one, is if you die. It's not passed on. But Shane is absolutely correct. It's not one of those with Chapter 11, Chapter 7, you know, how the consolidation, all that goes with the homes and things.
Right.
That is the one debt that does not go away. You are liable because you got it with the federal government. I want to make one comment here too, Shane. You can continue in a minute if you want to. With that, is that how I would do that? Is that I would look at what I wanted to major in. Let's say it's radiologist, or let's say it's a teacher. Let's say it's something to that. Whatever it is, I would research the pay. Second thing I tell my kids is, I got one in college now, is that research the demand over the next 5 to 10 years on where that particular position is going to be. Then I would calculate how much, what am I planning on borrowing based on, it all goes back to what we've talked about this whole month is budgeting. Okay, this is just an individual budget just on a student loan. Look at how much it's going to cost you for that 1 year, 2 years, an associate degree or full BS degree. And then look at how much you're going to get paid for that degree. And then calculate where my debt would be. And then how am I going to, with the job that I get, what year number am I going to be able to pay off it? What amount of money am I going to be able to pay off of it? In other words, is what we've been saying this whole time is having a what? Having a plan. Same way with a house or anything else. You're looking at that one particular thing and having a plan from start to finish on how that is the biggest mistake kids and adults make with student loans. It's almost like as soon as they get approved for $50,000, $100,000, it's like, oh my God, I got all this money. And they just completely go off track and they don't have their class schedule sorted out to where now they changed majors. Now they took a class they shouldn't have taken. And now a debt that was supposed to take $50,000 or $40,000 or $20,000 if you're going to community college, now is $120,000 to $160,000.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I would do with that.
Now, one of the positives of student loans is it's deferred interest. So it's not compounding interest until you
right.
finish school.
Right. right. That's correct.
So if you're taking out $10,000 a semester for your classes and books and all that, there's no interest accruing on that until you're year completed.
Awesome.
And they're checking with you every year to make sure you're still a student and, you know, you can file your taxes as a, with the exemptions as a student, but not forever.
Sure, sure. Good question. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah, I want you to repeat that, what she just said here, Shane.
So this lady works in payroll for a company, and the government has the ability to garnish wages to pay off the loan. So they'll track you down, and if you're earning money, they're going to get their cut. Same as, like, you know, alimony and child support and all of those type of things.
It's almost equal weight, isn't it? I mean, based on as far as how the government tracks you down or how strict they are with alimony and child support and student loans. Hard to believe student loans is in that same category,
yeah.
But it really is.
Yeah.
And off of student loans.
Yeah.
I can't speak to that.
I'm not familiar with Smart Dollar, so just tell me a little bit about SmartDollar.com. Is it like the budget, the budget.com? Or is it like EveryDollar.com?
I have no idea because I haven't even looked into it, but they offer it free at our job.
Yeah.
So it's just a budgeting tool that helps you.
It's a step-by-step plan.
Yeah, so it's the same thing. Okay, her question was about smartdollar.com, okay? And I'm not familiar with that one, but it seems to me it works the same way as everydollar.com, which is there's several of them out there that, and actually, I actually recommended a couple of months ago when I spoke about if you don't have an app that works really well for budgeting. I actually gave out individual budgets for handwritten, for those who won't just have to. I'm a visual guy, so I have to handwrite everything down. I have to see it, and then all of a sudden I absorb it. But they both work the same way with an app that actually allows you to put in your paychecks, put in exactly what you make. It's really just a glorified budget on your phone. But I think it's outstanding, especially because I operate my phone is almost, Lord forgive me, but almost my life in terms of I can't live without my phone. I got everything on my phone.
Yeah.
And it makes it very simple to just, in fact, I have used everydollar.com myself, and I click it on, and then I can just look, and I have everything listed, and as things come in, as things are paid, then it comes out. So, yeah, that's a great, great way of doing it, for sure. What else?
I think it's a good idea. So there's, it's called, like, the Pythagorean Theorem.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, he's a...
No,
I... I just throw it out there and say it wrong. He's like, yeah, no. But essentially, it's the power of writing things down. Yeah. So I'm the same way, very old school, and I keep notes. And then maybe you transfer it to something that's a little more accessible so you're not carrying around a big notebook.
Two or three ways of doing it. I have to first write it out, see it, then I transfer everything over.
Yeah.
But a great question there.
It sticks.
It does with me. That's how I learn. Yeah.
But that theorem is saying that the chances of the follow-through and something actually materializing, it's really powerful. So it's something about the way God created us and the brain.
Absolutely. Good question. Anybody else got another question? Yeah, in the back.
You mentioned investing outside of your employer for retirement.
Okay, so her question, let's repeat her question here. Shane?
So you were saying if you were looking at investments outside of your company, where would you go? There's actually a lot of good product that has the ability to outperform what 401ks do. I mean, I'd be happy to, and I brought a sheet if you guys want to follow up with any questions. You can, I'll give you a card and give me your name and email and phone number, and I can walk you through just a couple of different thoughts. One thing that I know is everybody should have some sort of life insurance because you don't know what you don't know. And just in the last 2 months, there have been two different deaths, unrelated people one of them was a pastor and was young, and it was a routine thing. He went into the hospital and just never came out. So those kind of things are unexpected. The way my wife's mom passed away was very unexpected at the age of 50, and we never got to say goodbye. So you don't know what you don't know, and you can't plan for it. So, we need to seize the day, and that's something that can help mitigate dealing with what's going to be the obligations of the state and taxes and everything else that comes with that. And I can share more and just kind of walk through, and really it comes down to where you are personally, your age, your
goals, and how much
your assets and your, everything comes into play.
Your means of contributing. So, and I'll comment on that too. So number one thing that Shane and I were talking about earlier was that number one, you always max out your what you have at work. Whatever they're willing to contribute, make sure you get the full benefit of that, because I always look at that as free money, right? Second thing, he did mention earlier on the couple of things to look at is your Roth IRAs, your traditional IRAs, things like that. And within those, there are a wide variety. You've got investment houses, you've got discount brokerages, you've got people. Index funds are tied or indexed to the S&P. A lot of people, you've got lists that are your top growth stock mutual funds that are invest in the highest quality companies that pay. I'm one of those old school guys that like dividend paying companies that pay a percentage of a dividend no matter what. They don't move very much in stock price, but they pay anywhere from a lot of them pay 5 or 6% that dividend. And I'm just kind of old school. I guess I'm not, looking for I'm not the big home run guy right away. I'm not like get rich quick. I'm like the steady guy. I'm a conservative. So I'm a steady guy that just consistently. That's what I look for. And so there are ways to find those. And, that'd be an after discussion thing for later on. But, yeah, there are ways to do that.
Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely. And you get the benefit. There are products that give you the benefit of all the upside without ever being exposed to the risk of like an 08, 09, where you build up $100,000 and the market cuts in half. And just to speak on that for a second, so if you had $100,000 in the market in 08 and 09 when it dropped, it took approximately, depending on what your portfolio looked like, 6.5 years for it to come back to flush, and then it continued up. So there are products where you get the benefits of being in the market, but it's called fixed indexed, and it gives you the ability to benefit from the growth of that fund or index. But then if the market drops or dips, like we saw in December last year, it was a 20% drop almost overnight, which it came back within 3 weeks, but it just protects you against those three steps forward, one step back kind of practice. But
yeah, I'm a diversity guy where I like things, and I'm not saying you have to, because I'm not a CMP by no means. I just enjoy it, and I have a degree in it, and so I just enjoy it. But I'm a diversified guy. So I'm a conservative where I like what I just talked about, the growth stock stuff and then your index fund. But then I'm also, I don't put everything there. I'll look for other ways to, I like real estate. I like things like that's tangible, that's valued. I'm not a guy, I do not carry any credit card debt. I never had credit card debt. So I've always been that guy who's, if I didn't have it, I did not buy it. And I think I told the last time I was here, I started when I was 14, and I've saved 10% of everything I've ever made since I was 14 years old, just because we didn't have a lot back then. And so I had to, that was my only way to figure it, to get out of where I was, to save a dollar, and eventually that dollar would get me farther out. But great question there. I want to, before you get run out of time, does anybody else got a question? And I'll let you comment here in a minute as well. Any other questions? There's a couple of great questions there. You go ahead. No other questions, and I'm going to let you go ahead and comment there on anything else with that.
Well, I was just going to say, so Pastor John was talking about the way that he likes to invest in the stocks, typically blue chip or S&P 500 stocks that pay out dividends. So if you did not take dividends, those would just be reinvested.
Right.
So then it becomes you're getting the benefit of the compound.
Right.
So that's just what that is.
That's just another example of, same with the CD. CDs, you know, that's just a typical very conservative, low-key investment. And most of the time, compound interest is paid either, I would say monthly, some quarterly, and majority of them probably yearly. And so you at least want to, the more it compounds, so if you go to some place, if you like CDs or whatever, then make sure that you get one that compounds earlier rather than later. In other words, if you find a CD over here that compounds monthly, and you like the same rate that compounds yearly, go with the monthly. Why? Because it's compounding 12 times over the year, right, versus one time.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah, absolutely. No other questions? Okay. You know, and we'll close out here in a minute. I know, Shane, I'll let you talk about it towards the end there. But I did want to say that as we close this thing out, you know, we talked about marriage dreams, and I talked about couple weeks ago, I guess now, that you know, to make your marriage and finances better, we listed a few things. It was your family, your finances, your kids, and your faith. Those are the four things that, if you want to change your current position, wherever you are now, get those four things in order. It may not all come at once, but you're working on each one of them. You achieve your dreams by those four things. Those who have never went through the whole process or endured to the end of a dream, then they've never saw the reality of what could have been. You know, I look at my life and things that I've set goals and set things, targets for. And I made those things happen by writing them down and shooting forth at them every day, every week, every month. And the thing is with me, I haven't accomplished everything. And I say with people all the time in counseling that, look, it may take you an extra month. It may take you an extra few years. It may take you an extra night class. It may take an extra job. It may take whatever it may be. It may take, an extra job, an extra degree, an extra something. Whatever you've got to do, whatever you have to do to make that dream a reality, you may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but as long as you're plugging away, something good is going to happen. Something, you can make something good happen in your life. Amen?
Yeah, I would absolutely support everything you said, and it's all about the having the right mindset and doing it with godly principles, where the four quadrants of what really should be the priority. But you've got to have a no quit attitude. And I've talked to so many people, even when I was young and working with other people, and they're saying, man, wouldn't it be nice? And my dad talked that way. And just so you know, my dad's pushing 80 years old, still is working. I've had to help him with bad debt because there was no retirement, no plan. So failure to plan is planning to fail. And the mindset that, well, God will take care of us, he gives us the tools. And, you know, we have the ability to be more of a blessing to others. And they've invested in me with a spiritual heritage that I'm forever grateful, and a work ethic that I know I wouldn't have without that. But there's more that could have been accomplished if there were those kind of principles that Pastor John was referring to.
Get committed. Open it up with that. Get committed. Whatever it takes, determining your heart and your mind. As I started it off just a minute ago, I'm going to end with it too, that you can start with a new year. And most people start with all these plans and all these goals in January, and by mid-February, it's already gone, already past the wayside. Determine in your heart commitment. I am committed to see things through. I may have failed that certificate to get my next promotion that's going to excel me in that job, but I'm going to take it again. I may have not accomplished what I wanted to last year, but I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep trying. I am committed to seeing my goals through. I am committed to make a change in my life, and I'm going to see something get through. I said last time I talked to my wife, and I said every January, and we go through, okay, what are we going to do this year? What are we going to accomplish this year? And every one of you, and those watching my stream, you'll be saying the same thing. What am I going to accomplish this year? And by the end of the year or January next year, you ought to look back. And if you have not accomplished something, that means you were not committed. You were not committed. And it's nobody else's fault but yours. So get committed.